Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Coming up on today's program, Dayton Youth Radio and another compelling Veterans Voices. We'll talk to EF Hutton CEO Chris Daniels about the company's relocation to Springfield. And later in the program, we've got more environmental news from the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier. And Bill Felker has this week's Poor Will's Almanac. Up first, more people in the city of Dayton are dying from gun violence this year. The problem is particularly severe in the neighborhoods of West Dayton. City officials say the number of gun crimes is also up, despite an overall drop in violent crime since 2011. To learn more about the gun-related homicide rate, we spoke with Dayton Police Chief Richard Beal.
Chief Beal, thanks for speaking with us today. We're here to talk about some recently released information about murder rates here in the city of Dayton and give us a summary of where we're at this point in December of 2016.
Well, actually, as of today, we have 39 homicides, a little bit different than what the Dayton Daily is, difference of one. There was a double count in the data. And likely one of those will be ruled as a justifiable homicide. So actually, criminal homicides at this point appear to stand at 38. And that's a significant increase from the last few years that have been below 30. So we have seen this increase.
And do we have any attributing factors for this?
Yeah, there's no simple, singular explanation. And one thing I want to point out, if we look at the data as it relates to gun crime with injury, we have not seen an increase in gun crime with injury. What we have seen is more deaths. And that can be a number of factors. It could be the weapon that you use. It could be how many times a person is shot. It could be, you know, where they're shot. It could be how quickly a person seeks or does not seek medical attention. So there's a lot of factors that drive whether someone dies or not. But we're not seeing more people being shot compared to last year. We're seeing more people die compared to last year.
All right. Are there any demographics that you can point to regarding this information?
Well, generally speaking, the gun crime aggregates in West Dayton, and generally speaking, the victims are more often African American. So that has been a pretty consistent trend over a number of years.
And how are police refocusing their efforts? Do you reevaluate your approach to the situation every year when these numbers come out?
Yeah, absolutely. We began focusing on this literally in 2008 when we implemented something called the Community Initiative to Reduce Gun Violence, which is a multi-jurisdictional law enforcement and community response to gun violence. And that was responsible for driving down our homicides. And in fact, in 2011, we had the largest aggregate reduction in violent crime in the city's 10-year history. So a significant decline in 2011. We've had some subsequent declines since then. So we have become a much safer city. And quite honestly, in 2011, the greatest beneficiary of the decline in serious and violent crime was West Dayton. So we made significant progress there. The last 2 years have been challenged here, I might add, because we've seen upticks in gun crime both of these past 2 years. And that has mirrored somewhat what's happened around the country and other major urban areas. So this is not unique to our city.
And what message would you have for the residents of Dayton who see this information?
Yeah, I think it's we all have a responsibility, every single one. In fact, I've said multiple times over the years, no one part of the community has more responsibility than another. You know, gun violence is a problem in our community. We made significant strides forward, but we all have to work to reduce it. So we'll be looking for a community support as we move forward. One thing I will say is that our clearance rate this year, crimes solved, people arrested and held accountable for homicides, is much higher than it has been in recent years, in part due to the use of some technology to help us investigations, but also citizens willing to come and help us more, step up and be witnesses and tell us what they know.
You see a change in that, in help from citizens and their willingness there?
Yeah, certainly this year it's made a difference. It truly has. And so, but isn't just really, quite honestly, being a witness to a crime, we really want to know when citizens are aware that there's a problem in the community, where there's some conflict. We really want to be ahead of this trend, this curve, this tragedies that happen. We want to prevent them, not respond to them. So we're really asking citizens that when you realize that there's some kind of a disorder in progress or some kind of a conflict brewing, let us know. Let us get involved. Let's try to see if we can't prevent something more serious from happening.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Take care.
That was Dayton Police Chief Richard Beal. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Today, our Veterans Voices series continues with a cross-generational conversation between a post-9/11 veteran and a Vietnam veteran. Wright State student and Air Force veteran David Morris of Riverside is studying social work, and he talked to his mentor, Air Force veteran and social worker Greg Merriweather, about counseling Vietnam veterans and how post-traumatic stress disorder has changed since then.
Vietnam vets did not trust the government at all, and they were not going to the VA for any kinds of services. And if they weren't coming in for VA services, there's no VA. Wow. So what they wanted us to do is get these veterans in. And so that's what we tried to do. At the same time, we just felt like they don't know what they're doing. They don't have any idea. There was no such thing as PTSD at the time. The DSM, the Diagnostic Manual, did not say anything about PTSD. It wasn't even a diagnosable problem. We called it post-Vietnam syndrome.
Did you see any conflicts while you were in the military?
I didn't. You know, I always thought I wanted to, but once I started working with veterans, I was glad I didn't.
Right.
I'd have been a messed up dude. I would have been.
While I was in the military, we had an exercise going on at that time. During the exercise, they're setting off mock bombs and whatever, so that people understand, you know, this is kind of what it's like if you're deployed. And a unit came back from deployment. Some commander decided that he was going to pull these guys back, and they were going to participate in the exercise. Yeah. As soon as they hear the sound of a mortar, these guys hit the deck, and they know that they're in an exercise. They know where they're at. They're at Hill Air Force Base, Utah. Instinctively, though, they hit the deck. I just watched in horror as these guys covered for their lives. And at that point, I don't think I knew what PTSD was, mm-hmm. but I knew there was something wrong with that reaction. Mm-hmm. If your reality isn't at the physical place of where you're at.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah. Go ahead.
What did you think about the folks who put that exercise on? I mean, why would anybody do that?
Right.
As my question. You're telling me this right now. I'm like, wow, you got to be kidding me. That didn't happen because we've already talked about this. We've already done this. But the fact is that there's so many people coming in now that don't understand how trauma works. They don't understand what war does to folks. I mean, this is like a never-ending thing because, you know, trauma impacts people for long periods of time. So I do think things are getting better because, first of all, we know what PTSD is. We know what trauma is now. So now we're doing not only post-deployment briefings, but we're doing pre-deployment briefings. This is what might happen. This is what you might experience. These are some of the things you might see. So now we really understand that we need to educate people before they go and when they come back and in between.
That was Air Force veteran David Morris talking to fellow Air Force veteran and social worker Greg Merriweather. Veterans Voices is produced in collaboration with the Veteran and Military Center at Wright State University. This series is supported in part by a grant from the Jacob G. Schmidlap Trust, Fifth Third Bank trustee. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Today on Dayton Youth Radio, we have a new story from Tecumseh High School in Medway about being happy with yourself and your choices in life. Here's Youth Radio Project Coordinator Basim Blunt.
Dayton Youth Radio gives teenagers a chance to tell their own stories in their own words. And we hear them, trying to figure out what the world is all about. Maybe you're listening to this story with your teenager. We hope it creates open and honest dialogue with the teenagers in your life. This next story is from Emma Harbaugh. She's a student at Tecumseh High School. It's about two people that she loves, her grandma and her girlfriend.
My story is about finding myself and just making one of the biggest choices I've ever had to make in my life. The day my life changed was August 23rd, 2015. This was the day I met my girlfriend of almost a year now. We'll call her Mitch. School had just started. It was a warm autumn night, and we were at this birthday party, and everyone was just hanging out outside. I remember this girl with a friendly smile, close-set blue eyes, and short, light brown hair that stuck up in the front, and a pink basketball t-shirt and blue jeans just really caught my attention, and I just found myself really wanting to get to know her. Now, me being a little out there and loud and, well, not shy to say the least, asked to take pictures together and asked for her Snapchat from one of my friends by the end of the night. Normally, with meeting new people, making plans is pretty hard because they usually fall through. I wasn't going to let that happen that time, though. We began to hang out quite frequently, and I just found myself really starting to like Mitch, but in a more than a friend way. I knew Mitch was into girls, and I've never really went that route before, so I didn't really know what was going on in my brain. But I'd say I have an open mind. Time passed, and we started dating at the beginning of 2016, and believe me, I've never been so happy in my life. But I still hadn't told my family. Now, my mom and my dad, that wasn't the hard part here. The hard part was getting us through to my grandmother, because she's not as open-minded. My grandma and I really do have this inseparable bond, though. She basically raised me. She's always been my go-to and my best friend. I mean, we really did everything together. Well, I told her. Her reaction sort of broke my heart.
We raised you. You are practically like our kid. I always had these dreams of you growing up to marry Keith Urban, the person you loved when you were little, or growing up and marrying a nice, handsome young man. So the day you finally told me, I was disappointed.
She completely shut it down and shut me out, too. She didn't even like the idea and said she would never come around. I guess girls dating girls and boys dating boys just wasn't something she was used to seeing in her lifetime. We drifted apart for a while, which I never thought would happen in my whole entire life.
So, what made you change the way you feel about me being in a relationship with Mitch?
Someone asked me if I loved you. And I said I love you more than anybody in my life. And that made me really think. It doesn't matter who you love or who they are, as long as they love you and treat you like I want you to be treated. And I apologize for being disappointed, because I think I disappointed you more. And if you ever get where you're not disappointed with me, I think we can go on with loving each other more than anybody else in our whole lives. I love you, Emma.
I love you too.
Mitch hangs out with me and my family just about every weekend, and they just consider her a part of it. I love my life, I love Mitch and her family, and I'm so content with my choices and with myself. Whether you're gay, bi, straight, black or white, it doesn't matter. I mean, everybody deserves to be happy, and we're all the same underneath, and times are changing, and this isn't an unusual thing nowadays to see with this generation.
That was a story entitled Happiness, by Tecumseh High School student Emma Harbaugh. Special thanks to Emma's grandma, Cheryl, and Michelle Peters, journalism teacher at Tecumseh. You can hear more stories by visiting WYSO or subscribing to our iTunes podcast. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blood.
Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Armott Boyer Charitable Trust, Fifth Third Bank trustee. This week, Springfield City Commissioners voted to approve a large tax incentive program for its newest corporate resident, E.F. Hutton. The financial industry giant moved its headquarters to the city earlier this year, promising Springfield officials it will bring more than 400 jobs to the city over the next 5 years. The company estimates the hiring would amount to more than $24 million in annual wages to Springfield employees. To find out what those incentives from the city mean for the company and how their move to Springfield has gone so far, I spoke with E.F. Hutton CEO, Chris Daniels. Chris Daniels, thanks so much for speaking with us today. Let's start by talking about the overall transition of your headquarters to Springfield and how that's going.
Sure. We made a very significant move, you know, across probably 800 or 900 miles, moved to Springfield, and move the entire operation. And one of the important things for us was to make sure that all of our executives work from our headquarters office. So over the course of the last couple of months, we've been building operations. I think we now have a good start. There's obviously still more to do, but what we've accomplished in a short amount of time, I think, is amazing.
It's been reported that at least one top executive left the firm because he didn't want to come to Springfield, but I imagine that's to be expected whenever companies move to a new location. Is the residency rule for E.F. Hutton executives, do you expect that to cause any big problems for you?
No, I don't. There's a lot of good, talented people in Western Ohio, and we look forward to recruiting in Ohio as well as elsewhere. But the important thing for us is that whoever comes to work in an executive role with E.F. Hutton work at our headquarters and live in the Springfield area.
First reports of your move to Springfield noted that you would be bringing more than 400 jobs to the city over the next 5 years, I believe. I'd like to know how hiring has gone so far. Are you finding the employees and the talent you need as this process has started?
Yes, and that's a great question. So we have found a number of good people. Just like anything else in hiring, you know, it's a process that takes a fair amount of time to build a base of good quality people. So that is proceeding and will continue to proceed over the course of the next, you know, months. And it will take, you know, certainly more than a year to build up to, you know, close to the 400 jobs that we are expecting in Springfield. But given our growth plan, I think we have a need for people, you know, sooner than 5 years.
The tax incentives recently okayed by Springfield City Commissioners is, in fact, performance-based. Is that based on hiring so many employees each year, or what does it mean for the company if hiring goals fall short by big or even small numbers?
So I welcome the city of Springfield's move to provide us with an incentive to hire more people in Springfield. And so that certainly helps our efforts. And I think it's very smart and forward-looking for the city to provide that kind of incentive, as does a number of other cities and municipalities across the country. So it will not be a function of how many years it takes to build up to the employment base. There are no quarterly or monthly milestones, but it certainly provides an incentive to be sure that we hire good quality people faster. Like I said, I think that's a smart move by the city, and we welcome that and delighted that they adopted that.
The city of Springfield is pretty high on the list, at least in these parts, for being a city in need of economic revitalization. Perhaps you could reiterate why E.F. Hutton chose to move its headquarters here and your outlook for the future of the company and the city.
Well, we think that Springfield is resurging. We are also looking for resurgence of E.F. Hutton. I know the city has been through some tough times and seems like things are moving in the right direction. You know, we are delighted to be a part of that, and whatever small part we can play in returning Springfield to its status as the champion city, we would love to be part of that and do anything that we can to help in that. I've personally moved to Springfield. I'm very happy to call Springfield home and also to be a citizen of Springfield. The city has a history of growing large-scale, nationally-oriented business, and that's what we're trying to do here as well.
I've been speaking with Chris Daniels, CEO of E.F. Hutton in Springfield. Chris, thanks so much for speaking with us today, and good luck with your operations here.
Sure, thanks. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
The search is on for new sources of clean energy, and one place to find it could be the Ohio River. The Ohio and its tributaries could become a hotspot for new hydropower development, not on big new artificial lakes, but on using the region's extensive network of navigation dams. But as the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier explains, not everyone wants to take the hydro plunge.
Behind a chain-link fence, Paul Jacob watches water spill over a dam on Neville Island on the Ohio River near Pittsburgh.
Our project will be just in the water.
The water forms a white froth at the base of the dam, called the Emsworth Back Channel, before flowing into the brown waters of the Ohio. To Jacob, that froth looks like opportunity.
If you look out and you'll see all the water that's flowing over that dam, that basically is unused energy.
Jacob is with Rye Development, a company that's proposed building a small hydropower plant at Emsworth and nine other dams in western Pennsylvania and West Virginia. If approved, the projects could come online by 2019. Emsworth is part of the Army Corps of Engineers' extensive system of dams along the Ohio and Mississippi River systems. And from Jacob's perspective, these rivers contain a wealth of untapped power.
It's wasted energy that's created by the fact that you've got a flow, a substantial flow of water, and the difference in elevation of the water. What we do is capture that in a turbine, so it basically spins a giant turbine relatively slowly, and then that spins a generator, and that produces the electricity.
The amount of energy these projects can create isn't enormous. The Emsworth Dam could power only 6,000 to 12,000 homes. That's a tiny fraction compared to the million or so homes a big coal-fired power plant or a hydro plant at Niagara Falls can produce. But even at this scale, these projects can benefit the economy and the environment, Jacob says.
It's a carbon-free resource. So once this is built, it'll just operate. The life of these projects is extremely long compared to most other resources. So it makes a good contribution in terms of adding a renewable resource that's also available on a 24/7 basis.
That last part is important. Wind and solar don't always produce electricity when the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine. So adding reliable sources of power is a big push for people trying to get more renewables onto the grid. Fast-growing wind and solar may garner a lot of attention, but hydropower is still the biggest source of renewable energy in the country, accounting for 7% of all electricity in the U.S.
I think that often it's, you know, talked about as the silent renewable.
David Zayas is with the National Hydropower Association. He says hydropower has been around for so long, some people assume there's no room for it to grow. But the Department of Energy says the industry could grow by 50% over the next three decades.
You know, the myth of that hydropower is all tapped out, and that, you know, I think Pennsylvania is a really good example of that not being the case.
With its plentiful rainfall and dammed up rivers, the Keystone State is well suited for hydropower development, says Lindsay Baxter of the Pennsylvania Environmental Council. She says hydro also fits well with what a modernized grid will look like.
The future of power generation is going to be more distributed, smaller resources that are very low or no carbon emitting. And hydro feeds into that and could be very complementary to some of the other resources like wind and solar.
Baxter's group is pushing for more hydropower, but it doesn't want big new dams that can wipe out habitat or displace homes and businesses. Instead, Baxter thinks building projects onto existing dams makes the most sense.
That's really where we see more of the opportunity, where you have a previously disturbed environment. Sometimes those can be retrofitted to produce power with very little or no impacts on the environment.
Actually, some worry new hydropower plants, even on existing dams, could be bad for rivers. On a recent afternoon, Rob Walters took me on a cruise up the Allegheny River, a few miles from where it flows into the Ohio.
A few times a year, and there is one guy fishing.
Over there?
No, over here to the left, see the white.
Walters is with Three Rivers Waterkeeper. The group monitors water quality on Pittsburgh's rivers, which have slowly seen fish populations increase after decades of industrial pollution. We're idling just below the Highland Park Dam, the site of one of Rye Development's proposed hydroelectric projects. He says this is one of the best spots on the river to fish.
Why are the fish there and not just, like, I don't know, in the middle of the river?
The dissolved oxygen. There's more oxygen concentrated at the dam. It's turbulent.
The dam acts like one of those aerators in an aquarium, infusing the water in this section of the river or pool with oxygen, feeding plants, fish, and other wildlife. hydropower plant would funnel some of the turbulent water into turbines instead of letting it tumble over the dam. State and federal wildlife agencies say this could drop the river's oxygen levels, which already run low during the summer.
Maybe not specifically in one pool, but the cumulative impact we're talking about, basically every lock and dam on the Monongahela River, the Ohio River, there already is one up on the Allegheny River at the moment. This would be another one.
The developer will need to negotiate with the Corps of Engineers over how much river flow and dissolved oxygen it can divert for the project. But Walters says oxygen isn't all that worries him. He points to a spit of rocks just below the dam. A man sits there on a portable chair. Next to him, a cooler, a bait bucket, and a fishing rod. Walters is worried this spot could get taken out by the hydropower plant, though he doesn't know what the final plan will look like.
To the gentleman that's up there, yeah, definitely looks like he's doing a little catfishing. This is his Yosemite. And why should we take that away from him? And he should have a voice in saying that, you know, every Tuesday afternoon he comes down here with his kids or his grandkids or by himself and he fishes and catches catfish and maybe he takes one home and he eats it.
Walter says he's in favor of clean energy, but he doesn't want it to come at the cost of the region's still recovering rivers and those who use them. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
That story is part of the Allegheny Front's series, Headwaters, exploring the Ohio River in partnership with West Virginia Public Broadcasting. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the second week of early winter, the third week of the bedding plant seeding moon. In the Emerald Tablet, an ancient text by Hermes Trismegistus, the author attempts to explain the astrological mysteries of the cosmos. The work contains the phrase, as above, so below. And indeed, the land does reflect the sky above it, and the Earth Watcher can create constellations and story no less than the astrologer. Both observers are horoscopers, or time trackers, who see and interpret shapes, signs, and scents from scattered arbitrary elements. And so the seasonal horoscope of the landscape around us is no less loaded with possibilities for alignments and predictions than a horoscope of fate and influence made from the sky by fortune tellers and psychics. Zeitgebers in the second week of early winter mirror the high markers of the stars. The deepest cold follows Orion after dark. The end of mating season for white-tailed deer announces Taurus in the middle of the night. The close of bird migrations tells of Sirius, the giant dog star that brings both snow and ice in January, and heat when it shines at midday in the summer. As distant and unimaginable as the movements of the firmament seem, so close and tangible and countable are the events of the immediate landscape. Star-like, these events gleam in their earthly setting, pointing to the hour of the year. The constellations of lanky, empty branches follow and reflect the high astrology of the sun. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the third week of early winter. In the meantime, touch the stars. They're all around you.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Thanks so much for joining us. Coming up next on WYSO, Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.